the timing of meeting you, I think, is perfect in terms of the global situation. We're in a crisis, or we think we are. It'd be a terrible thing to waste that crisis. It's an opportunity for change, if you like. In my relationship to money, as far as early as I can have any conscious memories about it, started in this nice middle-class professional family that was my home. My father was an architect. I was sitting at the breakfast table, and Mum said, "Oh, I need some money for shopping." And my father would pull out one of those lovely old copper plate £5 notes, and the white, big white notes about this big, copper plate writing on them. And I was like, "Oh, that's not much too much. I don't need that much, really." And he would stand up and say, "Plenty more where that came from, dear." Go off to London to work. It kind of encapsulates the sort of patriarchal attitude to money. So I was immediately sort of curious about, saying, what is this money stuff? What does it mean? And what's this dialogue between my parents about it? Then I actually wanted to study science, but I wasn't very good at it, so I studied philosophy. And that was at London. I graduated with a rather bad degree, decided I was unemployable with a philosophy degree, so I went to America and got, you know, something that made me really employable, an MBA, a sort of ticket to ride on the corporate bus. And my take on money then was, I want it, I want lots of it. You know, it'll solve all problems. Then got involved in multinational corporate financial wheeling and dealing and management and so on for about 6, 7, 8 years, until a friend said, "Why don't you come to Java? We've got this job. I've just finished my PhD research. We need somebody with practical experience. Do you want me to put your name up for it?" And I was at that time bored and somewhat repelled by the pharmaceutical industry that I was working in. So, hey, okay, to my amazement, found myself for 2 years in Java. Aid. Thought it was rather altruistic. You know, I'm going to stop working for a profit-maximizing multinational corporation and help these poor, benighted souls in the third world develop. Well, actually, what happened was the opposite. I found they knew everything that I needed to know, and I didn't know much that they needed to know. In fact, what I went there to peddle, in a way, because I was working for Harvard University and the Ford Foundation, was to make their country safe to be safe for American capital. So that was, in terms of my life, that was the halfway through my life to date. I was 33, I'm 66 now. And I had a very big change in my outlook. Came back to England, didn't know what to do. I had met Claire then. And we had discovered that we were life partners. It took us a long time to admit it, but eventually we did. And we moved. I went to learn to build boats, actually. But shortly after that, looking for a boatyard, I ended up in a spiritual community in the north of Scotland called Findhorn. Findhorn was a community experience for 6 years for me. And then I got to the point where I felt, I've got 10 years of this experience out there in the world with a lot of professional and technical input, and it was politically acceptable. But then I'd spent 6 years in a community that worked on consensus, spiritually orientated, might have called it a pneumatocracy perhaps. And I felt these two have to be blended somehow, they have to be integrated. And that's when I started the Financial Initiative, which Elizabeth spoke about. And that was the first, what I call the first congruent financial ethical financial institution in the UK. Congruent because its driver were some values rather than just profit maximisation. And it predated the very first ethical fund in this country by about 3 months. The Friends Provident Stewardship Fund was the first, which received a fairly rocky reception from its own technical people. They called it the Brazil Fund because they said the people who ran it were nuts. It then proceeded to outperform, even in financial terms, the the average of the unit trust universe. So, you know, gradually the salesman began to think maybe they could sell it. Moving on to the wrong page. So since that financial initiativist time, 25 years have gone by, and I've been constantly thinking of new things and discovering they were wrong and trying something else. So it's been a sort of learning process. Is somebody keeping time? Because I don't know. When do we have to... Well, somebody's keeping time. So we've got all together until a quarter part, till 12.
Till 12.
We've got an hour.
Yes, we've got
right.
An hour, yeah.
I want to exploit your questions and information and knowledge, because every one of you has got an experience of money. And every one of those experiences is valuable. And I don't want to spend the whole of this hour and a quarter talking. So I'm going to talk for as short as I can control myself to, and then hope that we have a discussion. So the next thing I come to is that, as I said before, I think to come here is a real privilege for you, because I think you're thinking about all these issues and you're looking at those money experiences and you're trying to relate them to what is going on out there in the world and working on kind of evolution towards an understanding of all that as a unity and you as part of that unity, maybe even you as that unity. And that makes it very ripe time, I think. So you really threw a googly at me with that title, Elizabeth. It's so provocative, and there are so many ways you can interpret it. But I had a quick look in the dictionary and came up with generosity as ample and of rich quality. And generosity... I came across a quote which dates back to about a generation before Muhammad. I don't know if any of you ever heard this, because it's probably an archaic phrase now, but people used to say, as generous as Halim. Mm-hmm. Now, Halim was a Bedouin leader who was notorious for his warlike deeds and his boundless generosity. Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting combination, a kind of spiritual warrior, if you like. And his son was a contemporary of Muhammad's, so that places him in time. The other bit of research I did on this weird title that he gave me was the Old Norse, greedum. It's the word which greed and greedy are derived from, which means eager, sharp, or pointed. And you know, later we've moved that on to acquisitive, covetous, materialistic, mammonistic, but the quality of all those is that they are insatiable. So that takes us into, I find that takes us into a very deeply spiritual realm of longing. You know, we're all longing for something, and these bastards keep giving us false satisfiers. You know, we want food and nutrition, they give us pot noodles. We want status, they give us a sexy looking car. And you know, after a year, it's not doing it for us, so we get an even sexier looking car. So there's that insatiability aspect. I'd like to just go to Shakespeare for a moment. I don't remember the speech from Hamlet, where he's, I think it's Polonius. Look then to character. Give thy thoughts no tongue, nor any unproportioned thought its act. Give every man thine ear, but few thy voice. They in France of the best rank and station are most select and generous. And I think he is getting us to the spiritual root of how can you relate to material stuff, and about sharing, listening, before you act, as he puts it, unproportionately. And there's one other thing I'd like to read, which is Samuel Butler, not the Erewhon one, the Hugh de Brastic one of a couple of centuries earlier, in his book, it's called Miscellaneous Thoughts. He said, all love at first, like generous wine, ferments and frets until 'tis fine. But when 'tis settled on the lees, and from the impurer matter free, becomes the richer still the older, and proves the pleasanter the colder. So he's really talking about that fermenting, settling, sharing, open-ended dialogue process, out of which we individually get our compass, our inner compass, if you like. So economics. Actually, the title I have was Economy, not Economics, which in a way is slightly wider, because economics is a very tarnished word these days. I mean, it has a very narrow meaning in the way we use it, in the way the power structure uses it anyway. Well, Lord Robbins, who was an economist, I suppose, in the 20s, said economics was the science of allocation of scarce means to unlimited ends. Very hopeless. No wonder it's called the dismal science. So that is based on poverty, consciousness. There's no question about whether the ends are good or bad. So, you know, when the Torrey Canyon breaks up and pollutes miles and miles of coast and kills off biodiversity, that adds to our gross domestic product. We are wealthier because of that, according to the economists. So that question is not asked by Robbins or by the classical economists at all. Measurement. How do we measure wealth? That isn't addressed either, really. I'm always... You know, well, people in our society, accountants and actuaries are pretty important people because they're the bean counters. You know, they count stuff, they put numbers on it. And I'm reminded of the joke I was told by somebody who actually hated actuaries, who said, what is the similarity between an actuary and a human sperm? I don't know if any of you can guess the answer, but they have about the same chance of joining the human race. About 1 in 240 million. Now, I don't think the fact that the sperm count is declining is any reason to think it's more likely that actuaries become part of the human race, nevertheless. So that sort of counting stuff, you know, we in our economy are very excited by what we find easy to measure. But the stuff we don't find easy to measure, we deny on the whole. We don't want to know about that. We can't control it. And... you know, this crisis that's going on now is a comedy in a way, because here you see a system collapsing and the powerful people on the planet throwing trillions of dollars at it, trillions of pounds at it, to fix a system that's basically bust. And that's why I say it would be a terrible shame to waste this crisis, and it is being wasted by those people. I suggest that you people here are not wasting it. I think you're thinking about alternatives to the system rather than propping up something that doesn't work. I mean, it may be your own life. Certainly in my experience, at certain points I felt my life doesn't work. So let's do something completely different. And it's a bit of a scary place to be, because all your security is rested on doing the things you've always done and doing what your dad said you should do and all that stuff. And you move on beyond that. That's the scary moment between the two trapezes, if you like, if you think of a circus act. Mm-hmm. It's that space when you've let go of one trapeze and you haven't yet caught the other one's bloody scary. But it's essential if we're going to move on. And I think Gordon Brown is in that scary place, but he's grabbed, I think, a trapeze with slightly dodgy fixings up the top. Cocteau, I had an interesting comment I think it's about economics, so he doesn't specifically say so. He said, maybe what we call progress has been the single-minded development of a big error. In other words, we're barking up the wrong tree, like there's no tomorrow. Another little quote that says it a lot better than I can in my own words, which talks about, you know, what is this that we've bought collectively as a society? And it's by a man called Dresden James. I haven't got a clue who he is, but his words are good. When a well-packaged web of lies has been sold to the masses over generations, the truth will seem utterly preposterous, and its speaker a raving lunatic. So I suggest we're all raving lunatics, or we seem like raving lunatics. And that's actually the way we need to go, because we are so collectively subject to the assault and battery of the media and of television and of the consumer society. This is very exciting, so I'm quite nervous. I'm shaking a bit. And I also feel this is a group where we're all heading much in the same direction, which is very encouraging. I still feel nervous, don't really know why. One other nice little quote about economists. The economist is an expert who will know tomorrow why the things he predicted yesterday didn't happen today. Now, what about money? What is money? Conventionally, we say it's a store of value. We say it's a measure of value. And we say it's a medium of exchange. And I question that, whether that's a very useful definition in terms of the evolution of the human race, because I'm pretty sure money is neutral stuff. It's a construct of our intellect and our emotions. And my feeling about money is actually, if you look around and see what is money, it's an agreement between people. You know, what do we give value? What do we accept for payment? Something that I think anthropologists probably have a good hit on what money's about, because as they look at customs, they see that actually what became money, whether it was cowrie shells, in one society it's edible rats, is what you celebrate with. In other words, there's a birth, a marriage, a death, a circumcision, a rite of passage, and the elephant tusks or the cowrie shells change hands. They're moved to the family or the person who is being celebrated. So it was there as a way of being the token, the outward sign of a celebration, or the memory aspect of a celebration. And I think we've been badly misled by being told that money was invented so we could trade. I mean, you go and see rainforest Indians, for example, who do not have any money, but who have an absolutely seamless trade system that is integrated with nature and with each other and the neighbouring tribes. You know, they don't need money to trade. So I think that has then led on to trading in money. Only about 10% of all the trillions of dollars that slosh around the planet are paying for goods. You know, they're money paying for money. They're manipulation. There's money moving from Zurich to New York because they get a 16% more interest there on a daily basis in trillions. That's why I put this up. This is the typical growth curve that the economists and the actuaries go for. It is a logarithmic growth, asymptotic to a vertical line. In other words, there is no end to it. Whereas any natural system, think algae in a pond, whatever, will grow probably at an even more rapid rate than compound interest to begin with, and then it will start, the feedback of the environment will slow it down until it achieves an equilibrium. And actually, maybe that's the kind of curve we should be looking for. It is probably also asymptotic. It never reaches that equilibrium, which is why a spiritual path is never ending. It's not worth having if you get there, if you like, let's say. There's one of the quotes I wanted to share with you, I can't find it at the moment. Another little story about the origins of money. I think it would go back maybe 5,000 years to Sumeria, where there was money, in a sense. It was called shekels. And shek means measure, it's like a bushel or something like that. And kel means wheat. And on the Sumerian coins was a wheat sheaf. And you gave these to the temple goddesses, who were in a kind of sacred prostitute. You gave them that money, and you made love with them. And this money supported the priesthood, which was an important central activity of the Sumerian culture. So it was a way of paying tribute. And the temples were also the wheat stores. And so that later we had the Roman Juno moneta, became money. I suppose we must have derived our word for money from moneta. But just in the same way as I was saying money is about celebration, so we have desacralized money through the ages. We've also tended to patriarchalize it. I mean, we call those women prostitutes. They were actually like vestal virgins or priestesses. And we've kind of monetized them in the sense of our modern money, completely misunderstanding what happened in that society. And later the Egyptians had a similar arrangement where they had, I suppose today you would call them government grain stores, and you deposited your grain there, it's like a bank. But they didn't pay you interest. They paid you negative interest. In other words, every month that went by, a small amount of your grain would go to the government, to the central coffers. So there was not an interest in hoarding, because you didn't earn any money through it. There was an interest in circulation and making it circulate. Oh, Sigmund Freud had some useful things to say about money, which I think throws some light on it. He said the desire for money and material gain is an infantile urge. And because of that, human beings will never be satisfied by material gain, money. They'll never be satisfied because it doesn't meet an infantile urge, which is about love, compassion, nurture, growth, creativity, all of those qualities. My next heading is humanity and money, really, which is how does all this relate to the big picture of the human race? As Elizabeth told me about Bullion's article, which I haven't read, but the gist of it seemed to me to be exactly a chord of what I see going on, which is that all through history, our beingness is expressed through materiality in some form or another, different material vehicles for our being, for our spiritual being. And right now it's materialism and science that we're dealing with. And where have they led us? We're not any longer using them to express our being, but this is what's happening here. And it's taken us to an extreme crisis, more extreme crisis in terms of the economists than we've ever had before. So perhaps that is saying, well, actually the currency of growth is different, of personal growth is different now, and we need to start thinking about that. And if you look, where is most of humanity on the planet? In China. So what should we be saying? Or perhaps I say, what should the current most powerful nation economically in the world, America, be saying to the next most powerful economic nation in the world, namely China? You know, what should the nature of that dialogue be? And I think there are probably four things that are important in that. One is about governance. You know, we hear a lot about civil rights and Tiananmen Square and exploited labor and all those good liberal Western things being thrown at China, who's just doing what we did 100 years ago. So there needs to be a non-judgmental and open-minded sharing between America and China about that. And of course, with America comes Europe and the UK, but I use America as the prime example. And there's a nice quote from a man called Robert Skidelsky. Do we have the moral resources to change our political and economic priorities? Because sure as hell we're going to need it if we're going to engage with China. Or will we revert to nationalism that blighted the 30s? The institutions and ideologies are no longer there, but the raw material of injustice is there. And once again we come to this is too good a crisis, it would be a terrible shame not to use it to catalyse change. I mean, the way I'd put it is, can we expand our consciousness enough not to react, not to respond in like vein, out of scarcity consciousness, out of a negative view of human beings, out of a non-abundance view of the cosmos? So that's governance. Partnership, you know, we keep talking about collaboration around the planet over political things, over civil rights, over economic things. So again, I think America needs to see itself as a partner of China. It's trodden a route that China is treading or trying to tread now. They're also going to do it differently. It's a different cultural setting. But that sharing that can take place is vital. It's the wine settling on the lees before you actually move into action. Third area is, you know, we hear a lot of talk about the G8, the eight most powerful economic nations in the world who meet in Davos. I've left a few bits of paper here, which, and there's a little bit about Davos. You know, what did we learn about at Davos last month or a week or two ago? And, you know, we're talking about going from a G8 to a G20, for example. So let's include Brazil, these other growing big chunks of humanity, China, India. So a diplomat I was reading about the other day said, I was talking to a Chinese diplomat, and he said with a wicked twinkle in his eye, how about a G2? Yeah, which absolutely encapsulates the power issues behind the economics or whatever tools we brandish to exercise power. I mean, in Java, what we saw was there had been these wonderful sultanates that had been there and the Dutch worked together with, and the tool of power was rice, basically, rice. Millions, tens of thousands of peasants working around the Kraton, the palace, and paying their dues to the Sultan in rice. When we arrived in Indonesia, they were adopting a new tool that was called economic development. And the Sultan of Yogyakarta was the vice president of the country. So that suddenly the tools had shifted from sharing rice to this tool that had been imported from the West called economic development, which was all the stuff that I've been talking about so far. So again, the G8 issue, it's obviously got to be exclusive, it's obviously got to be sharing. It very importantly must not be the X most important, most powerful countries in the world. It must represent the world. You know, we've got a global economy, but we haven't got global governance. And I think at the moment the debate is a little bit along the lines of, well, China wants power without responsibility. You know, in the old model, that's what China wants. Whereas America wants China to take responsibility without having power. Well, this is on a hiding to nowhere. You're not going to get anywhere with that debate. And the fourth thing, I think, is just about cultural exchange. Deep exchange. One of the insights that I had after I'd spent 2 years in Java, thinking, well, first 6 months of it, thinking I was doing a really good service, and then realizing that I wasn't, was I thought at that time, perhaps the best aid program is absolutely equal exchange. You know, our peasants in Somerset go and work with peasants in Java, and peasants from Java come and work with peasants in Somerset, and doctors in Java come and work in a practice here, and doctors from Scotland go and work in a practice there. So they're working together, rather than one of them going there and working with the sort of implied assumption that there's a transfer of knowledge or technology in one direction only. So deep exchange. I sort of felt I had a responsibility today to talk about socially responsible investment. And actually, over the 25 years that I've been involved in it, it's become less and less relevant. It's been co-opted. I mean, after the war, for example, in one sense, we began on an ethical investment process because during the war we'd incredible poor health and safety conditions. We'd have people producing armaments in appallingly dangerous conditions, and there were many appalling accidents where arms factories blew up and hundreds of people were killed. So health and safety and all these things, all we kept adding on little bits and pieces to, which were not the drivers of the economy, but they were the band-aids, if you like, to protect the negative effects of an entirely growth-driven economy. Somewhere in, I'll just say a little, I mean, what I'm hoping is that when I stop talking and we have a bit more of discussion and questions and answers and stuff, I'll get an idea of what you want to talk about more. If it's about socially responsible investment, fine, but I'll just give you a very brief outline. More or less began in this country with the Methodists, who suddenly realised that their portfolios were being invested in gambling companies. So, two kinds of socially responsible investment initially, what I call positive or proactive, which chose something of value and decided to support it. And then there was the negative screening approach, which was actually predated it. The France Provident Stewardship Fund was the very first fund, launched in June 1984, and it had a positive statement which was sort of apple pie and motherhood, you know, very, very general, that which conduces to the benefit of society as a whole sort of statement. Then a whole list of no-nos, you know, no gambling, no alcohol, no tobacco, no oppressive regimes, you know, with very, you know, some of which were very questionable. You know, perhaps it's a good role for alcohol. You know, perhaps it's a social lubricant. You know, there are lots of questions that could be raised about all of those, although they were deeply felt, absolutely morally and spiritually correct aspects to them as well. But on the whole, I don't think you can transform the planet by saying, thou shalt not do this, that, or the other. There has to be a positive driver behind it. And as all of us in this room would probably say, that positive driver is not a legislated thing. It comes from in here. It comes from each individual. So there were funds which did proactive, positive things. There were funds that avoided the bad. There were engagement funds which said, we'll more or less invest in anyone, but we will go to their shareholders' meetings and we will put our moral or ethical or environmental points of view forward and argue them strongly. And you know, the Brent Spa event back then was a good example of that. And after that, at Shell's shareholder meeting, a motion that was put on the agenda, not by the directors, but by a body of shareholders who came together was carried by 18%, which was extraordinary. I mean, to have 18% support anything that wasn't put on the table by the directors of the company was extremely unusual. And then there are what you could call cause-based investment funds. You might have a vegetarian fund, for example. You might have a human rights fund or a fund that focused on importing fair traded goods from places like Palestine and other countries where they needed to get their goods out in order to be able to afford food, education, shelter and other basic human needs. Nice one. I think we're nearly there. So what have the impacts of ethical investment over the last 25 years been? I mean, it has encouraged people to move in a good direction. There's been a bit of persuasion. It has got major companies to at least talk the talk, if not walk it as well, about all the corporate social responsibility issues of human rights and women's rights and oppressive regimes and honesty in advertising, all those things that, you know, we would normally expect to be part of the playing field within which capitalism works, you know, some of the limits to capitalism, if you like. So those things have been, while behaviour hasn't changed that much, companies have rung up a flag saying we are ethical, which have then opened them to broadsides of criticism, saying, well, you say you're ethical, but you're doing this. You know, well, there's Ogoni tribesmen in Nigeria. That isn't very ethical, is it? So it's opened up a debate. It's funded quite a lot of green technology, you know, the whole ethical investment movement, and socially themed businesses, although we're still struggling to get an idea of what a social enterprise is accepted. You know, and to my mind, it has to be driven by a social goal, but it also has to be profitable, it has to be well run, it has to be viable, it has to generate profits in order to develop and grow and become more effective. That's, you know, the sort of infrastructure of thought forms around enterprise do not include a definition of social enterprise like that. There isn't a social stock market, for example. There's an ordinary stock market in which all the ethical funds have to compete on the basis of material aims. So it's almost as if they've got to do things that they think is going to cost them more, reduce their profits, and make more profit at the same time, if they're going to attract the investment that they need. I think another thing that's developed is that the whole ethical investment world has become a bit less preachy, like we're ethical and you're not. You know, the first reaction I had in the City of London when I said we're an ethical investment company, what do you mean you're ethical? You know, in the city, we our word is our bond. We don't benefit from insider trading. But do you invest in arms? So there was a complete disconnect between what ethical meant. And again, spiritual, not acceptable word, you know, the S word, dangerous, don't go to that territory, but actually that's going to be the answer. I'll just finish up with another little vignette about the crisis, which is the banking crisis, particularly the credit crunch, which is the most topical one at the moment. Is if you add up all the assets of the top 60 global banks, which is probably about half of all the banking in the world, they've got assets of $10 trillion. We know there's a huge amount of toxicity in there. We don't know how much it is, we don't know where it is, and nor can we measure it, because people without a contextual holding, in other words, brilliant young whiz kids with algorithms and computers, have come up with models where you just push the button and it tells you what to invest in. There isn't a human context to it. So we don't know how good that $10 trillion is. And so far, we have only thrown $2 trillion at it in America and Britain and Europe. So there's 80% of the crap has still got to come out, or be at least tested. So we're only, in my opinion, we're only a very short way down the road to where this meets the straight line, which of course it will never actually do. But the intensity of the process, as that gets closer to that, gets more and more and more. So give thanks for crises. They are opportunities. There's a convergence happening now, I think, between what people like us are thinking and doing and feeling about, you know, who are we, what are we, why are we here, and the self-serving answers, if you like, to those questions that are being given by the mainstream system. Thank you very much.